Hello, everyone. This is Kay Tenenbaum with another edition of the Saturday Evening Post. American Pop. This is written by Cable Newhouse. Sneaker madness. Athletic shoes have evolved from predictably boring footwear into functional art. They've found soul. Gucci, the luxury goods maker, last year began selling a line of sneakers that come pre-smudged. That's right. Filthy from the get-go. For a pair of these, Gucci will gladly accept your $870. What's that you say? You'd like something a little more obnoxious? Okay, hand over $1,590 and Gucci will attach a strand of crystals to those scruffy shoes. Happy now? And now, The Lighter Side by Philip Gruley. Fall out of favor. Some folks love autumn best of all. This writer begs to differ. I was at the hardware store the other day and overheard a man tell Ed, the manager, that fall was his favorite time of year. Ed, because he's congenial and likes to keep his customers happy, agreed that fall was a wonderful season, but I could tell he was lying because no one with half a brain likes fall. The glories of summer are past. The drudgeries of winter are looming. And along comes fall, dressed to the nines, promising what she can't deliver. Fall is the political pledging to drain the swamp, the alcoholic vowing to turn over a new leaf, the televangelist guaranteeing a miracle. Fall is the carnival barker of seasons, beguiling us one moment, picking our pockets the next. I was thumbing through my mind recently, recollecting whether anything good has ever happened to me in the fall, and couldn't think of one thing. I met my wife in the summer and married her 2 summers later. My sons were born in the winter and summer. My granddaughter in the winter. I've been fired twice in my life, both times in the throes of autumn. One October, a semi-truck hauling tofu ran a red light and T-boned me, obliterating my favorite truck, combining in one fell swoop the three things I most despise: semis, tofu, and October. I once took a test on the internet to find out the month and year of my death based on my health, lifestyle, and age. I hit the enter button, watched the circle spin at the center of my screen, and then was informed I'll clock out at 2052 at the age of 92, in the month of October. It didn't say how I will die, though I'm certain my death will be autumn-related, eaten by a bear, accumulating fat for the winter, run over by a distracted leaf gawker, or sucked into a combine. I'm not saying fall is without its charms. The leaves are beautiful. Once one overlooks their suicidal habit of hurling themselves to the ground and skittering across the earth, clicking like rickety bones. I do enjoy the Laotian weather, neither hot nor cold, and therefore pleasing to me, if not to God. Then again, fall's vacillation is troubling, its effort to please everyone, its constant search for the middle ground, to be all things to all people. Say what you will about summer and winter, at least they have the courage of their convictions, even if they kill us with heat stroke or hypothermia. As I write this, it occurs to me I'm not that fond of winter either, which means half my life, from October to March, is a miserable slog. Fortunately, I like spring and summer twice as much as anyone, so it comes out even in the end. I recently read a story of a man coming out of a 6-month coma. I hope if I'm ever in a coma, it starts in early fall and ends just as winter is concluding. My family would be gathered around my bed upon my awakening. "Don't you remember anything from the past 6 months?" my wife would ask. Not the first thing, I would happily report. It takes a man of restitute courage to so openly scorn a season everyone else admires, but I'm not one to be swayed by public opinion, no matter how strongly the winds of judgment blow. If I ever have enough money, I'm going to buy a second home in Australia so that when autumn starts here, I can move there for 6 months just when spring is starting. Philip Guiley is a Quaker pastor and author of 22 books, including the Harmony and Hope series featuring Sam Gardner. In My Life by Todd Pitlock. The Signpost. When my father died, he left no plans for a burial or any means to record that he'd even set foot upon this earth. I had to do something. Whenever I voiced a complaint, my father would say, "Put it on my epitaph." In a more serious mood, he would speak about the importance of leaving your mark. But soon before he died, after a decade of illnesses, injuries, infections, and all manner of indignities, they wrought on him, body and soul, he told his wife he simply wanted to be cremated. She intended to scatter his ashes by a tree on their property that he liked to gaze upon. That didn't seem right. Although neither burial nor stone are universal, a marker says, "I was here," in a way that addresses a need both for the one who is leaving and the ones left behind. I called the cemetery where his parents and older brother were buried. Bruce Jaffe, the cemetery salesman, suggested affixing a bronze plaque to my uncle's headstone. I liked that idea. My father had admired his brother. Bruce asked what I wanted to say. A plaque has space for 4 lines, about 25 characters per line, depending on the font. A full headstone typically has space for 7 lines, like some prehistoric form of Twitter. I realized then that I hadn't given it any thought. I was even a bit embarrassed, as if I'd shown up for an important test completely unprepared. Usually, people put the person's name, the years they lived, and their relationships, said Bruce. Okay, I said, let's do that. But when I got the proofs of what the marker would look like, I had second thoughts. I wanted to rescue my father from oblivion and fix a place in the world for him, and I felt as if this wasn't quite doing the job. Epitaphs, even spare ones, can tell us a lot about elicit all kinds of responses. My rabbi, Jacob Rossner, once observed that the real meaning in an epitaph isn't the years of birth and death, but the space between them, sometimes noted in a dash, sometimes just blank. Those are the years when a person made choices that shaped their life. Epitaphs have always fascinated me. In a sense, they narrate a cemetery. A few months earlier, during a visit to southern Myanmar, which used to be called Lower Burma, I visited the war cemetery in Thein Bu Zat Yat. Between 1942 and 1943, 13,000 Allied soldiers died here. Prisoners of war, whom the Japanese enslaved to build the 258-mile Burma-Siam railway line. The prisoners died of starvation, cholera, Dengue fever, and malaria. They died of exposure to extreme heat. Some were killed when Allied forces bombed their railway line. Here, the epitaphs of more than 3,000 of them, set in lodges in the ground, were more than markers. They were messages from parents, siblings, and wives, terrible cries from broken hearts. To an H.H. Shand, always in my thoughts and forever in my heart, your loving wife, Pat. T. Nolan died on September 29, 1943. sadly missed by Dad and Mam, brothers and sisters, R.I.P. And J.R. Wooten, aged 24, August 1942. In precious memory of my beloved only child, a dear son and a brave lad, mother. The messages were from the living to their dead, and now all the survivors were surely gone, too, and the epitaphs preserved their terrible losses and gave them all a voice, almost in a ghostly way, in this most concise literary form, from the grave. Not every culture has epitaphs. Up in the Arctic Circle of Western Greenland, the world's largest island after Australia, with just 57,000 people, new graves in the cemeteries are decorated with ubiquitous arrangements of artificial flowers, which, when they wither from the elements, are not replaced. "We do not visit graves," said Salk Hard, a Greenlander I met while traveling there. "Once a person is gone, we go on to the future." And because of that, Greenlanders don't use epitaphs, not even names. They are officially evangelical Lutherans, but retain many of the beliefs of their Inuit heritage, including that every person consists of a body, a spirit, and a name. When the body perishes, the spirit and the name travel together in search of a new body. "If you put a name on the stone," Salk explained, "it will never leave the grave. It will be trapped, obviously." In my dissatisfaction with how I'd handle my father's epitaph, I reached out to my friend Milos Kurek, who lives in Prague and specializes in funeral arts. "I'm afraid there is no proper way," he wrote back. "A person may prepare his own, but it's quite rare, usually celebrities, exhibitionists, people with a special sense of humor. I myself created an epitaph for my old friend who was 95 when he joined the majority. He was my professional colleague, studying cemeteries a long time before me. On his tombstone it says, expect on funeral art. Excuse me, that's expert on funeral art. My intuition told me such an inscription would be fully justified, funny, and that he would appreciate it. The epitaph is, of course, for the living, yet we tend to ask ourselves, what would the dead want? How much does it depend on where they are at a particular moment in their lives when you ask? At the time he died, my father was completely defeated. All he wanted, he said, was peace and quiet. Oblivion in all forms appeared to him as a state of complete repose. But the conclusion of his life was not the sum of it. My father was a husband twice, a father three times, plus two stepchildren he was close to, and a grandfather 10 times. He relished that, at least the idea of it. But what he really loved was being a street fighter of a lawyer, watching television, playing golf, and enjoying long afternoons of cards with his friends. And food. Grandparenthood was his period of superannuation, and he fell into deep holes of depression, mourning his health and vitality. So why write that he was a grandfather when what mattered was being a lawyer? But honestly, Jordan Pittock, attorney at law, club champion? Jordan Pittock, good eater? It brought to mind the Greenlander's view of tombstones, not so much that by putting my father's name on his brother's stone, a piece of him would be literally trapped and bound to the earth, but that the words written on his epitaph would be too narrow and trap his identity. Perhaps, I realized, the Greenlanders are right, and death, including what we fix in plaques and stones, really should just be the great and final liberation, and that when we cross the frontier beyond words, we should get to take them all with us and leave none behind at all. In truth, my father didn't like to be bothered over details. He'd say, "Do whatever makes you happy," which was simultaneously sincere and indifferent, and was generally the source of his own pleasure and problems. At the unveiling to acknowledge the marker, it still gnawed at me that I hadn't done more, and that I couldn't help but notice others had. And that just as some people have become active participants in planning other end-of-life matters, so too are they crafting their final words. One in particular got my attention, a headstone shared by Bess and Marty Katz, noted their attributes. Bess, feminist, listener, mentor, organizer. Marty, generous, artistic, calm, cultured. This was tender and touching. Marty, who lived to be 95, outlived Best by 11 months, and I can easily imagine her loss was what finally did him in. But I could easily picture how my father would have reacted. He would have laughed out loud and wondered, what were they thinking? And I think I know, too, what he would have advised me. "What are you making a federal case out of it for?" he'd say. "What difference? What do I care? I'm dead." But even if a marker really didn't matter to my father, I know it would have mattered to him that it mattered to me, and that he would have understood my effort to create a signpost of his life, however inadequate it was, as a final act of love. Todd Pittock's last piece for the Post was "My Life as a Meme" in the July-August 2019 issue. Go with the flow. Tap into your inner Jackson Pollock by hosting a poured art party. No paintbrushes required. This popular new offering at art studios can be easily set up at home. You need a canvas, craft acrylic paints, and pouring medium available at craft stores or online. Mix in small individual cups, stir together equal amounts of craft paint and pouring medium to allow colors to blend but not go muddy. Pour. Drizzle each color mixture as desired onto a canvas laid flat. Tilt. Tilt the canvas to let the colors run into unpredictable and striking ways. Allow to dry at least 1 day. Post-its. This is compiled by Wendy Braun. Ask the manners guy. Coupe de Swill. I brought an expensive bottle to a dinner party. The host thanked me, put it away, and opened a bottle of El Cheapo Chardonnay. What's the best way to hint that you'd like to drink the wine you brought? Came from Dale in St. Louis. Ah, the old vino switcheroo. If you truly can't stomach a few glasses of the cheap stuff before moving on to your precious petite Syrah, you've got to be bold. Upon setting foot in your host's home, announce your bottle and, in the same breath, ask for a wine key so you can get the party started. If this critical window of time passes you by, scan the appetizers for something that, you will claim, pairs beautifully with your wine offering. You'd better be able to back it up with an explanation of the delicate notes. Grand Paparazzi. I live in a retirement community, and I'm sick of hearing about everyone's wonderful grandkids. If I see one more cute baby picture, I'm going to scream. This came from Mandy in Indianapolis. Smartphones are a blessing and a curse. There is seemingly no limit to the amount of banal, out-of-focus snapshots that can fit in those things. There is one magic phrase you can use when you feel the deluge of show and tell coming on. I've seen those, followed up with something like adorable. Odds are that they've also shared their pictures on Facebook, and subjecting you to them again would be downright cruel. If they are cruel, or just clueless, and won't back off, whip out your own device and give them a play-by-play of your recent cruise to Cuba. Sometimes you have to play hardball with these people. New movies. Seriously good films. Noted film critic Bill Newcott, creator of AARP's Movies for Grown-Ups, offers his picks. Fiddler, A Miracle of Miracles. It came out August 23rd. Fiddler on the Roof has been performed somewhere on the planet every single day since it opened on September 22nd, 1964. As if to prove that claim, director Max Lakowski travels the world to film cast, belting out Fiddler standards like Tradition and Sunrise, Sunset. Best of all, he sits down with octogenarian Israel star Topol, who played Tevi in the 1971 film. Luskowitz also interviews Broadway legend Joel Grey, who directed the all-Yiddish version of Fiddler, now selling out in New York. Midnight Traveler, that opened September 18th. Afghan film director Hassan Fazili had a choice. Face certain death from the Taliban, which had put a price on his head, or escape his native country with his wife and two young daughters. He chose the latter, and with nothing but some smartphone cameras, he created this intensely personal, sometimes harrowing account of the family sneaking across borders, lurching across open fields, and sleeping in freezing forests as they try to make their way to safety, if an uncertain future, in Europe. The Current War. This will open October 4th. Held back from release for nearly 2 years after its original production company went belly up, this enthralling historical drama about a titanic face-off between Thomas Edison, Benedict Cumberbatch, and George Westinghouse, Michael Shannon, is well worth the wait. The stars are compelling as the ingenuous inventors who, in the late 1800s, battled over how best to deliver electricity to the masses. As feuding moguls, Cumberbatch and Shannon offer a pleasantly charged history lesson. For biweekly video reviews of the latest films, go to SaturdayEveningPost.com/movies or check out Bill Newcott's website, moviesfortherestofus.com. Three questions. Brian Setzer, back on tour with the Stray Cats. Like the title of one of his hits, Rock This Town, Brian Setzer took up the music world, giving new life to rockabilly and that potent blend of country and R&B. In the 80s, he and his band, the Stray Cats, scored top-selling albums and sold out concerts with songs like Runaway Boys and Stray Cat Strut. As he told me, rockabilly had that primal energy that early punk rock had, the sound, the girls, the cars, the whole thing. After the Stray Cats broke up in 1984, Setzer, still sporting his trademark pompadour, went on to win 3 Grammys as arguably one of the greatest guitarists of all time. He got in on the revival of big band swing with the Brian Setzer Orchestra, and over the years has sold more than 13 million records. Now, he and the Stray Cats are bringing rockabilly back with a new album and a tour. Jeannie Wolf, why did you decide to bring the Stray Cats back after all these years? Brian Setzer, our drummer Slim Jim Phantom called me and said, the 40th anniversary of our first show is coming up, and We have to do something. When we started rehearsing, it's like you're riding your favorite bicycle again. We've got chemistry and still have the old magic. We call the record 40. We weren't sure who would even come to the concerts, and I think 20,000 people showed up at the first one. Jeannie Wolf. When you just want to kick back and enjoy some good music, what would I catch you listening to? Brian Setzer. You're probably going to laugh. I've got shaving music, truck driving music, evening music. When I'm driving during the day, I put on a Sirius Bluegrass channel or the Outlaw Country channel, which I love. At night, I put on some jazz or some blues. The best sound is my old tube stereo record player. But when I'm out and about, I just plug in my crappy little boombox with some rockabilly music or some old Lightning Hopkins or something. When it comes to recording technology, we've always mixed old and new. We kept the old, the tape echo, twang, stand-up bass, reverb. It's just about whatever makes it easier to capture that sound that's in my head. Jeannie Wolf. You say the blues don't stand a chance when you get up and dance. Is that the motto that keeps you going? Brian Setzer. The crowd eggs me on. They excite me. There's a lot of people out there that just go through the motions. They kind of get up there and play. I can't wait to do it. I'm a worker. It's hard to kind of keep me at home. I just turned 60 and I went, where'd that number come from? Sometimes I look back at myself and go, I can't believe that you're in the same body after that crazy stuff you did when you were 18, but you're still here. What gives me the most joy is banging around with my dogs and doing physical things. I rock it off on my motorcycle. That's how I really clear my head and get song ideas going. I need to get out on the open road. And again, this is from Jeannie Wolf as the Post West Coast editor. Hero Kids, Jaquil Naeem Jackson. Jaquil was only 5 when he accompanied his aunt to hang out warm bowls of chili to the homeless in his hometown of Chicago. I felt really sad when I saw how they lived, he says. When he realized many homeless people don't have basics most people take for granted, he started an organization, Project I Am, to hang out bags packed with toiletry items. In 2016, Jaquil handed out 1,600 bags on the streets of Chicago. With a growing crew of volunteers and supporters, this year his goal is 19,000 bags. It makes me happy to see others happy, he says. Ask the Vet's Pets, Downplay. Dear Daisy Dog, how can I stop Chester, my young pointer mix, from jumping on me and the other people? I was told to knee him in the chest when he jumps, but that's not working. Daisy responds, Chester is jumping on people because he wants attention. So let's use that information in some positive reinforcement, which is always more effective than aversive training, to get what you want. When Chester jumps on you, turn your back to him so you're not making eye contact. Don't speak to him. Raise your hands into your armpits so you don't inadvertently pet him if he rubs his head against your hands. As soon as he has all 4 on the floor, turn around and ask him to sit. When he's sitting, praise him and pet him. If he jumps again, repeat the process. He'll soon learn that the best way to get your attention is to sit. Ask the Pets Vets is written by Daisy Dog and Christopher Cat with a little help from veterinarian Lee Pickett, DMV. Send questions to Daisy and Christopher at editors@SaturdayEveningPost.com and read more online at SaturdayEveningPost.com/AskTheVetsPets. Well, that wraps up this session of the Saturday Evening Post. I'm Kay Tenenbaum, and we'll take another look next week. Good night.